Blog Talk Radio.
Becoming my favorite part is just mice and singing along, and it's like, and the ribbits in the background.
The ribbit. Ram
it.
The ribbit.
Ribbit.
That's when you know it's a fishy. The ribbit. Ribbit.
Rip it. Rip it. That's a story that people of a certain age with a military history will remember. Have you ever heard of ribbits, Mason?
Ribbit. No.
Yeah.
This
so here's a little bit of
like the 50s.
No, it was recent. This is my generation in the Army. I recommend do a Google search. There was a drink, and I guarantee you everybody who was in the Army or the Marines when I was in is like, oh, shit, we're talking about Rippets. There was a drink that the Army gave out this contract to. It was an energy drink. So it's supposed to be like Red Bull or like any of those other energy drinks, right? Except
yeah.
This one was made mostly from chemicals that the FDA had not approved yet. So you would get very intoxicated, but not like in a drunk way, in a like a speed demon way, like I can walk through walls kind of way, just off like two rippets and a little bit of cigarette ash. There's an old Army cocktail in there that we used to make. So I'll give you a hint. Go ahead, Google rippets.
People to drown.
More or less, but yeah. Like drowned by breathing air. You know what I mean? It's like one of those, like your body just locks up. It's so hyped up. Anybody who remembers, hit us up. Give me your Rip It stories. We'll make them happen next time on Tertio Radio because I got a bunch. But this is a semi-family-friendly show, and I'm not telling my Rip It story. That's a damn thing.
It definitely sounds like one of those that'll make you drown. Like you drink it, and you think suddenly you can walk on water.
Like, oh, this is what liquid cocaine does. Okay, yeah, no, I can do this. Yeah, sure.
What's funny about you saying that is like when you're talking about it, you start thinking about like serving and stuff, is like when you Google it, the first video you see is Marine Rippet energy drink, and this guy with like his shades on looks, I don't know what he's saying, but the screenshot of him talking in the camera is priceless.
I bet it is. You're going to have to link me to it, man, because I haven't even looked in a decade. There's no way that Rippet's still – they've got to be – somebody took them to court, I'm sure, and won $30 million. Like, I drank one Rippet, and my entire liver dissolved. And the people who make Rippets were like, yeah, that'll happen. It's on the can. It's your fault for drinking it.
It's a really good chance that somebody did take them to court.
I'm sure.
Oh, man.
I'm sure.
You're going to have to tell me about this Rippet story off air then. All right, so how's the day going? You know, I feel like every single Rams fan out there, their day should be different, considering that there's a winning record to make you feel better. How was
we
your
ended
day
the streak, man?
Up this morning,
we ended the streak. I tagged SB Nation. I let them know it's over. Every single SB Nation site now has covered a winning season. We were the last ones. Our last winning season was 2003. It's weird. It's just weird.
That is weird. That is so weird. And just, it's kind of crazy, really, when you think about it. But, man, the drought is over.
What's been great is to see everybody's stories of, like, where were you the last time, you know, the Rams had a winning season? And granted, 14 years is a lot of lifetime to get through. So everybody goes back 14 years and, you know, oh, man, I was 40 pounds lighter, or, oh, I still actually like my wife, or any of those stories is like, you know, 14 years is a long time, so anything you can pick up from there. What's your story? 2003, last time the Rams had a winning record, where was Mike in his
14 life? Years ago, I was 15, and I was just finishing up my sophomore year of football, yeah.
Drinking pomegranate tea.
There you go. No, I hadn't become the avid tea drinker that I am now.
Oh, excuse
you
me.
Know, the sophisticated tea drinker that I am now. You know? Now
I have a picture of you in my head, like
with a
pinky. Yeah, I was gonna say like one of those cognac. What do they call them? The cognac kind of glasses with your hand underneath, shaking it around. Elderflower. Yes, of course.
Yeah, exactly. I was Shannon Sharp. I was Shannon Sharp before Shannon Sharp, the black and yak.
Shannon
the
Sharp.
The and yak.
Shannon Sharp. I was trying to get you classy. Shannon Sharp is assy, and Shannon Sharp is other non-family friendly things. Like that.
I know, right? Well, I mean, hey, if you don't know about Shannon Sharp now and his mouths and yak, then there's a problem. Family friendly or not, I think everyone knows about
that. If you don't know what milds and yak are, that's where you need to do the education. Get you learned up on some black and milds or golden milds. You ever had golden milds?
No.
That was the first
thing, right?
Time I started to try to graduate to classy. Was you know what? I'm done with black and milds. I'm done. You know what? I'm getting the hood out of my system. I'm graduating to golden milds without realizing, oh, shit, this is equally as hood. This is a no-go, too.
It sounds like the hoodest thing ever, golden milds. Like, what?
Here's the thing. I'm 99% sure it was a black and mild just in a different case and just charged up an extra 50 cents to make you think, oh, now I'm living.
Well, you know what? After yesterday and becoming a winning team for the first time in 14 years,
everyone was
entitled to a golden mile and some yak. And if you didn't want to do the yak, you should do a rip it.
Oh,
it's
man.
Your choice.
Be careful. Listeners are going to drop by 15%. Just everybody falling off. My ears don't work anymore. I had a sip of that rip it, and all of a sudden I can't hear on my right ear. I don't know what happened.
The Rippet was the Four Loko before Four Loko, but like
it
on
was,
steroids.
That'll be a thing. Watch, I guarantee you the NFL, there's a thing somewhere where the NFL is like, look, we really care about player safety. We're trying to minimize concussions, but the first step we've taken is to make sure none of our players try Rippets. We care about their internal organs too much. No Rippets for anybody.
Rip is taking over the NFL, completely changing the what you're allowed to put
service.
In the body list. Oh wow, I'm gonna have to definitely look at the video after the show. It's gonna be interesting.
Yeah,
it's gonna be interesting. I feel like
it's a rabbit hole. It's a rabbit hole you can go down. I'm sure listeners are going down it right now, saying, "What the hell?" I guess I gotta check this out. Check it out. Fun times.
Well, so we're going to be joined today by everyone's favorite, none other, the man, the myth, the legend, RVD, Ryan Van Bieber. This is going to be a good day. Definitely going to be a good day. We're a winning team. We got the man, Ryan, the phoenix rising from the ashes, the resurfaces, showing his face again, stepping away from all his duties of running the NFL for SB Nation. And it's just like, okay. We're gonna be having fun tonight. What in the world are you doing?
I was texting Ryan Van Bieber. What was I supposed to be listening to and responding to?
No, I guess your phone, it does that vibrate thing when you type, right?
I don't know. Did it? See, this is what happens when we run a very professional podcast. Everybody, we are definitely aware of what's going on here.
Look, there's no such thing as professional when you've smoked a golden mouth. You are
the
unprofessional for life. For life. That's,
somebody out there knows exactly what I'm talking about. But here's the thing, though. Anybody who responds to us, it's like, of course I know what golden mouth. Don't admit it. This goes on the public record. I took the fall for you. I was your scapegoat.
Like
I can soak up all the
like
golden mild shame.
Like, that sounds like some of your Texas stuff, like your sardines and mayonnaise sandwiches. Like,
this is an easy
like
one. Everybody can just go, I have no idea what golden milds are. I've never heard of such a thing. What? Why would I have ever heard of such a product? I got out in front of that for all y'all. Don't waste my sacrifice.
Well, look, let's go. Let's dive in while we wait for Ryan to jump on. I'm sure he'll be over here in a minute. It's something I've been wanting to talk about, because when I was watching it yesterday, I was just like, you know what? Joe can't complain. He should be happy. And that was the defensive line. It wasn't necessarily that there was a lot of blitzing, but just the line was getting some really good pressure. What did you think of that pressure yesterday? They had 6 sacks.
How good
should have been 7.
How good was Michael Brockers?
I don't know why they didn't count Robert Quinn's sack, but
yeah,
they were getting after him.
How good was Michael Brockers, man? He had game of his career? I mean, obviously we're getting to the point where when you're talking about guys like Michael Brockers, Roger Saffold, Trumaine Johnson, and even Ogletree, those are like, you know, the longest veterans on the team. They've never been in this situation before. They've never played late season football. So as tenured as they are and as long as they've been around, when they have a good game at this point, you're talking about the game of their career. And I get it. Maybe Arizona Cardinals aren't necessarily, especially when you look ahead to the schedule, we got Philly and Seattle up next. Maybe a game against Arizona can't necessarily count as the game of the career. But, man, Brock had a game. And Aaron Donald, I mean, it's one of those things you try not to understate how damn incredible he is. But he's just so damn good. And when Brock's having a game like that next to Aaron Donald being himself, those two can terrorize a line by themselves. It doesn't take much more.
I mean, Aaron Donald was about a half an inch away from his third sack at one point in the game in the fourth quarter, you know, just barely escaped playing average, a big guy with some mobility. So that's any other quarterback, I think he gets that third sack. But Brockers definitely had himself 2 blocks. I mean, man. And the first thing I could actually think about, which is so crazy, was when he got that second block, my immediate thought was the day he was drafted. I remember sitting there. I was at Hooters with some friends, and we're watching the draft. And when he gets drafted,
drinking a ribbon,
one of the highlights from LSU is of him blocking the kicks. You know, mm-hmm. So it's like he has a history of it. And that was the first thing that I thought about. That's something he hasn't lost yet. And, you know, over the years of being with the Rams, this isn't the first time he's gotten his hand up and get his hand on a kick. But this is the first time we've seen it twice in one game from him. So I definitely, man, he was kind of all over, and he was really disruptive. Disruptive in the pass game. He was really, really getting after Gabbert. Didn't get any sacks, but he kept flashing. he was flashing quite a bit.
And got in the backfield. Let's bring on RVB, man. I got an RV here. Let me see if we can bring him on, especially because we talk about Michael Brocker. Somebody goes back to 2012. Mr. Ryan Van Bibber, editor of the NFL for SB Nation. What's up, man?
Hey, man. What's going on?
What's going on?
We're talking about Michael Brocker. First thing I have to point out, this is episode 21 of season 9, Ryan Van Bibber.
Damn.
Season 9
Damn.
Of Tertia Radio. I know. It's one of those things. We were just talking about the idea of, now the Rams having a winning record, and obviously yesterday's game against the Cardinals. But going back to 2003, where we were when the last time the Rams had a winning record, where was Ryan Van Bibber the last time the Rams had a winning record in 2003?
2003, man, I'd have to think about this a little bit. I was still living in Colorado at the time, so it was I was watching football in the bars on Sunday where I worked and hung out quite a bit. So that was kind of how I decided. I'm like, man, I could talk about football with people all day and get paid for it. That'd be a pretty sweet deal. So here I am.
You've done a pretty damn good job at it, I would say. So I have a question for you. Did I explain to people what it is that goes into your job? How would you explain what the NFL editor for SB Nation does?
Meetings. Go to a lot of meetings.
No. That's about right.
No,
that
was pretty
simple.
It's deciding what we cover and how to cover it. Because, you know, obviously we don't get, we don't have, you know, an unlimited staff or anything like that. So it's like we got to kind of pick and choose what we cover and how we cover it. And we have a network of, you know, as you well know, 32 team sites. And, you know, we are sort of complementary to that. I mean, we want to be part of that coverage, but not stepping on anyone's toes or anything like that. So, you know, I think it's just kind of you know, a big part of it is determining, you know, how we want it to, you know, we want to be different from, and the whole reason we started Turf Show Times in the first place is because we wanted to be different about how we talked about the Rams than what we got with the old game recaps and reports from the locker rooms that the radio and newspaper was giving us at the time. So I think that's kind of the, at the core of everything we do, whether it's Eli Manning getting benched or the Giants being a disaster or whatever. So,
so Ryan, just kind of going back to yesterday, what did you think of this Rams, like, defensive front just getting after it? Like, they, we haven't seen them perform this well, like, all year. You know, just strictly the D-line, just by themselves, just getting after the quarterback. I thought it was their best game of the year. Like, what was your thoughts on what you saw from the crew, Brocker?
It's good to
who,
see.
It is,
like,
right?
You know, that wasn't the offense's best game. You know what I mean? Like, the offense has been,
yeah,
obviously,
yeah,
the big story this year has been Jared Goff is doing really well, and the offense is great. I mean, it went from the Jeff Fisher offense to this powerhouse offense. And, you know, they didn't have their best day yesterday. But, you know, the nice thing, I think what's so great about this Rams team is, you know, we saw that last week against the Saints, is like, you know, when one part isn't quite all at its best, you've got the other part that can kind of hold up its end of the bargain too. And I think that's really what is so incredible about this team right now.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a question for you because you, oh, go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead. You got it.
It was just because you mentioned Jeff Fisher and because, you know, we get trapped inside of Rams bubble so often.
And I get it. People want to trash Jeff Fisher and he's an easy scapegoat for everything. What is the sense, given that the Rams have so many people, that we're talking about Michael Brockers, Roger Saffold's having a phenomenal year, Todd Gurley looks reborn, Jared Goff's career, even though he's only in his second year, looks resuscitated. A lot of what the Rams are doing is just getting more out of the guys that have been there, right? And so when you've got Jeff Fisher gone and guys like Jared Goff and Case Keenum look like competent NFL quarterbacks, what is the sense from outside the Rams bubble of what kind of quarterback Jeff Fisher is? Because obviously if you polled Rams fans, they've probably got him as the worst head coach in the history of the sport. Is that hyperbole outside the Rams bubble, or do people outside of this circle think somewhat similar?
I mean, is he the worst coach in NFL history? I mean, probably not. I mean, you know, you still got, you know, Marty Morningwig's Lions and and sort of the legendary moments like that. I mean, you know, the thing that makes Fisher such an NFL commodity, made him such an NFL commodity for 22 seasons, was that he was always sort of consistently mediocre. I mean, you know, he'd have those games,
sure,
with those terrible Rams teams, and they'd come in and beat the Seahawks when the Seahawks were at the top of their game. And so you'd always kind of wondered about it. And I mean, he can take a bad team, a 2-win team, and turn them into a 7-9 win team. And it's just sort of like, you know, there's a respectability that goes along with it. I think the biggest condemnation of Fisher to me is that it's a good example of why you can't give the head coach authority over personnel too. I mean, I think that you've got to,
sure,
I think there's a case to be made for separation of powers in that regard, because, you know, you look at the changes, it's not just obviously the coaching's tremendously better, but, you know, the roster decisions are much better this year. I mean, do you really think they would have drafted Cup if Fisher had still been in the draft room? I mean, do you really think they would have, you know, gone out and signed Andrew Whitworth if Fisher was still in there? I mean, I'm kind of dubious of that.
You know, my question to that is, how much do we really think that has changed with the personnel decisions with Fisher being gone? Like, I fully 100% believe that in that first year or two, that was like all Fisher. But then after that, you know, you start looking at some of the personnel moves, and I'm not 100% sold that it was all Fisher, you know, with the exception of the Gurley pick, that has a Fisher written all over it. Yes, Gurley has panned out, but it was probably the dumbest pick they could have made, even though he panned out. You know, they just had so many other things they needed to do, and they had a staple of backs. They didn't really need to make that pick. But that had Fisher written all over it. But outside of that, in the past two or three drafts, I feel like that was a lot to do with me. Now, I definitely feel like last year was with the Jared Goff trade and all of that. You know, the reports came out saying that it was Snead who initiated all that, and just took it upon himself to go and start and talk to John Robinson and say, hey, let's make a deal, you know, and go get his guy. And then you have Mike Silver, I think it was, who came out saying that it wasn't Fisher didn't want to take him, you know. So how much is it now that's really different from when Fisher was here? I know in the beginning it was probably all Fisher, but at some point it seems like Speed took the handles. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was both. You know, I mean, we know that Fisher had ultimate say over personnel. Now, I think the Goff thing's interesting because, you know, there was pressure to get from higher up than just Fisher to get a quarterback, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot of those decisions that you wonder about. I mean, you know, drafting how many defensive linemen over the years, and, you know, a few of them panned out exceptionally and a few of them kind of don't work. And then you have, you know, how many picks did we draft running backs with? I mean, was just, you know, I mean, I'm glad they got Gurley. He's definitely a special player. But, you know, you look at the team over the years, and they probably would have been, all things considered, probably would have been fine, you know, had they gone other directions besides running back after running back with those first 100 picks that they moved. And I think, too, you look at some of how the players have panned out in other places. That's always kind of interesting to me. It's like, why is LaMarcus Joyner having his best year ever now? And why is,
yep,
you know, I mean, Aaron Donald's always been great. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, he was a force on Sunday. But, you know, the rest of the line is playing well around him. And you really, there's like, and you know what's kind of funny? It's like, this isn't really much of, you know, Robert Quinn, pretty quiet contribution-wise this season. Not just a huge output from him this year. So, you know, they're finding these guys that can kind of get it done in ways that, you know, and we all thought this would be a transition year because, well, they're moving from a 4-3 to a 3-4 defense. That usually, you know, that usually takes a year to get the adjustments made and players used to it and everything like that. So, I don't know. It's just, you know, it's a completely different team than it was at the start of last season. And I think there's probably a lot of reasons for that. And a lot of it has to do with Jeff Fisher. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with the fact that, you know, the Rams we've seen over the, it's funny, since we started Turf Show Times in 06, with Linehan's first year as head coach, and just how much of the Rams history that we've covered over there has been about just an organization constantly plagued with infighting. I mean, you know, the breakup with Mike Martz and how ugly that is with Sean. I can't think of the other guy's name, the bean counter guy. Damn it. What was his name? It was sort of the de facto GM for a while. That had no
Jay Zignan.
What?
Jay Zignan.
Yeah, maybe, but no, you know, no football, not a football personnel guy whatsoever. And then Linehan and those guys get in. And then Spagnuolo, you know, with all the crazy Nixonian shit inside the building that Spagnuolo's doing. And then Fisher and the, you know, the power structure, the way that's all settled and stuff there. And then, you know, lo and behold, they moved to Los Angeles. It's probably the best thing that happened to the team. I hate to say that for my St. Louis peeps out there, but.
Sure.
It exposed Fisher. He didn't have the protection that he does in a small market like St. Louis.
Yeah, you know it. You mentioned Gurley and just kind of what he's been. You know how good he's been, and he's really, really been good, especially this year. One thing that I don't like to say, I hear people say too often, is that he recaptured his rookie year form. I think that that's kind of like spitting in his face, right? Because when you get outside those first four starts, he didn't really do too much, you know, whereas this Gurley is like a consistent game after game after game Gurley, where he's bringing it every single week, and it doesn't necessarily have to be. You know, you look at his rookie year, there, a lot of his, you know, big games came from one big run, you know, where his yardage was all piled on from a 50-yard run, or, you know, he had a streak of 50-yard runs or whatever it was. You know, that's not the case this year. You know, he doesn't have a bunch of 50-yard runs. He doesn't have any 50-yard runs this year, you know. So that's not the case this year. He's more so just very consistent, grinded out, and not just like 3 yards, but he's consistently getting 14, 15 yards on runs. And I like this Gurley. But the thing that I like the most is his receiving, you know. Yesterday he led the team again in receiving, and, you know, it's like, how good has he really gotten at that? And where, you know, Joe, I want you to answer this too, but where should we begin to rank him amongst the league's most complete backs?
I mean, it's pretty good. I mean, you know what's so interesting, I think, with McVay this year is how much they've used him in the passing game, unlike, you know, you saw in the past with Gurley. I mean, it's a pretty smart move on McVay's part to get him the ball, that to find ways to get Todd Gurley the ball. He doesn't have to be a beast when he runs it. He, you know, he can be just as effective in the running game. I mean, he's a, you know what, he's got 48 catches on the season already. I mean, that's the NFL or the best of his career so far. So it's a, you know, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to confuse him for, say, you know, Lamar Miller or Marshall Faulk or anything like that. He's just not that kind of back. But, you know, he's an offensive weapon, and they're using him like one. I think that's, you know, to credit McVay, they found really smart ways to use the players they have.
And I think what's interesting is, you bring up, like, Lamar Miller, and obviously Mark. There's always going to be, you know, a connection to Marshall Faulk just because he's on the same team.
Yeah.
You know, Todd Gurley crossed 1,500 yards from scrimmage this week, and we're only through three quarters of the season. So he's on pace, I mean, albeit by the tiniest of threads, but on pace to cross 2,000 yards from scrimmage this year. That's the kind of thing where and because it's only his third season in the NFL and the first season in whatever kind of system Sean McVay wants to build here, I don't know what kind of a running back he's turned into, Mice. And, it's hard to say what his ceiling is because this is by far his best NFL season. He's got the best personnel and the best coaching staff to work with. So it's hard for me to get a sense of the ceiling.
Well, yeah, it really is.
I mean, I think it's too early to really identify his ceiling because, like I said, you know, he's so different from what we've seen as a rookie in last year. You know, we might as well X that out. There's no way you can even compare what he's doing now to the person you saw last year. It's two completely different people. So as far as the ceiling goes, you know, that's hard to tell. But just looking at the landscape of the running backs in the NFL this year, like, where does Gurley fit in that mode? We know he's in that top tier just from like I said earlier, that consistent grinding, and this is something I was actually thinking about during the game. And truth be told, I just couldn't come up with answer because he's different. It's hard to explain it, but he's different, and it's not a bad thing. It's not the greatest thing. He's different from other top backs. You know, he doesn't necessarily look like the other top backs when he runs, and you know, he doesn't play like other top backs. But he's clearly in that conversation. If that makes sense,
I think. And this is one thing that the Rams are starting to shed. I mean, obviously it's the first year since 2003 with a winning record. It's going to take a little bit of time to really wipe this off. But the Rams always had that sheen, that extra layer of, you know, shinola on top that prevented people from the national media from creating the narratives for their good players from everybody else. So take like Aaron Donald. Aaron Donald on what, half the other teams in the NFL would have gotten a Defensive Player of the Year award by now. Steven Jackson would be, I mean, think about the way that people talk about Frank Gore, right? And how he's an automatic candidate for the Hall of Fame, or look at some of these wide receivers, the way they talk about them, that they don't talk about Isaac Bruce. And part of the reason why, and this is just my opinion, part of the reason why is because for 12 years, the Rams were such a bad team and never threatened any, you know, playoff sensibilities outside of 2010, obviously Sam Bradford's rookie year, was that the Rams were just an afterthought, and nobody had to pay attention to them. You could just follow them along from, you know, SB Nation coverage the day after or whatever. You didn't necessarily have to actually get a sense of who this team was as they played and watch them and say, God, Steven Jackson's incredible. Aaron Donald's incredible. You could just follow it along and be like, oh, yeah, that bad team has a good player. So I think one of the things that we've got with Todd Gurley is people got these headlines, and he won Rookie of the Year, and they said, oh, this guy must be really good. I haven't seen him play. And then maybe last year they turned him on and was like, yeah, I guess he's fine, but this team stinks and he's not spectacular. This year you've got a really good team with a guy that's getting good, and if the Rams get into position, they're playing the Philadelphia Eagles next week and Seattle the week after and are all but certain to go to the playoffs. If Todd Gurley has a big game in one of these games, it's going to be a career-defining game from everything that he's done to this point. And that's the kind of thing where when you talk about like a Le'Veon Bell or Ezekiel Elliott, or Adrian Peterson. Those guys have had those kind of games. Even Ezekiel Elliott in his second year, he's already had those kind of games where on national TV, he's got a national audience that sees him break out and win a game against the Pittsburgh Steelers last year. That's the kind of game that announces your presence into the national kind of zeitgeist that Todd Gurley just hasn't had because he's been on the Rams and it's taken us this long to get back to this kind of football.
Yeah, for sure.
So yesterday, and we're going to move on from this game, but real quick, yesterday I noticed something with McVay, and it stood out to me. I know I was talking about it in the chat, Joe, but it stood out to me. And it was the past couple of weeks, there's been a few instances, but I think yesterday was the worst, where I saw some questionable play calling, you know, where I think he admitted to as much in the post game when he was just kind of talking about what was different in the second half. And he's saying how, you know, certain adjustments needed to be made. And he just was kind of being stubborn with it, you know, kind of being bullheaded and refusing to switch the approach in the first half. But you saw him running a lot of plays where you're just like, why, you know, like if that's not working, you saw what is working. You're kind of getting away from it, like giving the ball to Gurley or just pushing it up the gut. And as opposed to giving it to him on the edge or even giving it to him at all, you know. And then, of course, you have the poor clock management. And, Joe, I know something you've been harping on since week one is the way that he uses timeouts. And in this game, he decided not to use them at all when they could have set themselves up for an opportunity to put the ball in the end zone to close out the first half. You know, that was some of the worst clock management I've seen all year, to be perfectly honest. And I don't mean that just from the Rams. I mean from any team. It was bad. The Rams had a lot of time on the clock, and he just let it run until 9 seconds, and then they finally called a timeout. So my question is, do you think that we're kind of seeing that rookie wall for the head coach where, you know, you've exhausted so many ideas, now you're just kind of going with the flow, or if this is just rookie mistakes?
Oh, what were you going to say, Ryan? Go ahead.
Well, I just feel like, if, you know, every coach has a bad game. It's not like, you know, he's not like Andy Reid, where you're an established repeat offender when it comes to clock management, not knowing what the hell to do with your timeouts kind of thing. But,
and, you know, he's still so early in his career, just as young as he is. And by young, I don't mean necessarily age. I just mean experience. I mean, he's only played 12 games with Jared Goff. And so, obviously, there's a lot of complexity to what he's trying to do when they hurry up to the line and all that stuff that's been talked about. And they just haven't gotten the timing right. And you saw they took the delay of game early on in the first quarter when they were back. That's the same issue, right, is that they're not synced up on, you know, at 25 seconds in the play clock, you need to be here. 15 seconds, you need to be here. 5 seconds, you're at the line ready to snap it. They're just not synced up. And, yeah, I'm fine to chalk it up to a rookie head coach. The thing is, you know, the Rams are out to 9-3. And, you know, Sean McVay said in his comments today, these are the kind of things that lose you football games. But it didn't yesterday. And so I think that's the other side of the coin, is that they've just been good enough to maybe take these kind of mistakes and not get shot in the foot by them.
You know, the best thing about this Rams team is, I've always said, for as long as I can remember, the best teams, they're going to handle business against the teams they should handle business against. You're going to have teams that's good, and those teams can win on any given Sunday. But then there's teams like the Colts, like the Cardinals, you know, like the 49ers, the Giants, those games where you should just handle business. This is the first time in 14 years that the Rams have handled business with those games. So when you say that, you know, when Sean McVay says, you know, those are the things that lose you games, the good teams overcome those things. And I think this is, you know, more than beating a Saints team or, you know, maybe if they beat the Eagles, more than those things, I think these little things like that is what really shows. Because, like I said, a good team can beat one of the best teams any day. Ryan, you already mentioned it, under Jeff Fisher, when they're in the bottom of the barrel, they'll go beat the Seahawks, they'll beat the Broncos, you know. So a good team or a decent team could beat a great team any day, but it's the best teams that do those little things right. Now, speaking of the little things, this is kind of a little thing that has snowballed into a big thing at this point in the season, but the Rams' run defense, it's horrendous, you know, and it's something that I've noticed in week one. It was bothering me watching Frank Gore, those old legs, churn out 4.6 yards a carry. They just had to get away from it. But I was nervous about it then, and I'm terrified of it now, especially going into the playoffs. Can the Rams survive in the playoffs with this run defense?
I mean, you'll get a good sense of that this week because it's the Eagles, and that's, you know, they do both things really well on offense. So, you know, it should definitely be better, and it's probably good that Alec Ogletree isn't hurt worse than he is. But But, you know, I mean, I don't think it's, like, as far as Achilles heels go, I'd rather see a team, you know, if it were my team, I'd rather the run defense be a little rough than be, you know, a situation where, you know, there's a whole side of the field that's easy to pass against. You know what I mean?
Kayvon,
you're so foolish. Ready to scream it from the mountaintop. Come on.
I was waiting for that opportunity. I got to give a shout out every show.
What I think is going to be interesting, and we saw it yesterday, is that, and I know Ryan probably hasn't listened, is that, you know, for a while, Meissen's been going in on the run defense, and I've had an issue with the pass rush. And I think maybe for whatever it is, whether it's the era that we're in the NFL, or maybe his skill as a defensive coordinator, or maybe it's the personnel, Wade Phillips has found ways to kind of deal with, you mentioned Robert Quinn not necessarily being the Robert Quinn of old, right? That maybe there's a way to get around it, whether it's blitzing, whether it's disguising different rushes, whether it's working from the inside when you've got Aaron Donald. I think for the deficit of talent that we've got, Wade Phillips has the experience to find ways to still get some pressures on quarterbacks, at least to disrupt their offensive timing. What worries me on the run defense is I don't know that there's a way around it. I don't know that you can finesse your way to run defense. And maybe that's the Achilles heel when we get into this most important stretch. I think the good thing is no team's perfect. Every team's got flaws. And if that's our one flaw, you know, you took a lump against the Vikings. You got it done against the Saints. You can't win every game, right? And maybe that's just one of those things where we try to figure out how are you going to win games if we struggle in run defense against some of the better teams. And that'll be the challenge maybe moving forward.
Yeah.
All right, so talking about moving forward, this Eagles game, this is the game that I think everyone has been waiting for. I know it's been circled on my calendar for a long time. I've mentioned it way too much and before the week even got here. But the Eagles matchup is here. You know, I think you have people that think it's going to be fireworks just because of the points per game averages that both teams bring in, and then the point differential that both teams bring in. This is 1-2 in both categories, you know. So it's I think the expectation is for there to be a lot of scoring and exciting game. But I'm not crazy about that. The one thing that I was harping on pretty hard, probably like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, when I was once again talking about this game way earlier, getting ahead of myself, but I kept saying that the Eagles really haven't played a lot of good teams. And when you go back and you look at their schedule, there's a lot of teams that's picking in the top 10, you know, and up until yesterday, they hadn't played more than two teams that had winning records through half the season, which was the Chiefs and the Panthers. They lost to the Chiefs, and then they barely got past the Panthers. So my argument was, are the Eagles slightly overrated? I think they're a good team, but are they a bit overrated? Then you see last night they play against a good team. You know, yes, the Legion of Boom is rocked because you lose Cam Chancellor and Richard Sherman, but I think that the media has put such a light on the Legion of Boom that they forgot about that front seven. Like, that's a loaded front seven, like really, really good.
Yeah.
But the defense is still good. And Russell Wilson is playing like a top three quarterback in the NFL right now. He's absolutely carrying the team. And I think they said he's accounted for 87% of the offense and 96% of the touchdowns. So it's like – that team is really good, and you saw the Eagles play a really good team, and they didn't look nearly as dominant. I'm not so sold that this game is going to be, you know, that the Eagles are so much better than everyone else, or they're on such a high cliff that it's like this game is going to get away. Like, what are your thoughts on what you should see, what you are expecting to see, I should say, in this game between the Rams and the Eagles?
Well, you know, the thing that jumped out about me, excuse me, with last night's game is, why did, you know, Doug Peterson comes out, you know, the secondary's banged up in Seattle. The front seven is not banged up.
Yep.
Why does Doug Peterson come out and insist on throwing the ball as much as they did? I mean, you know, you've got these running backs. The Eagles have a good stable of running backs. Why don't you use them? I mean, to me, you know, if Philadelphia comes out in the first quarter and pounds the ball, it sets a different tone. I mean, yeah, you're probably not going to get 4.5 yards a carry right off the bat. But, I mean, I think it's just one of those, you know, this sort of a – I mean, I felt like I was watching Andy Reid coach a game last night. I mean, it was that. I know, obviously, Peterson that's where Peterson is on, that's his coaching tree. But it's just, you know, that sense that you're going to pass the ball to win, that just doesn't. And I think that the good thing about the Rams is they don't have a reluctance to use the running game when it works for them.
You know, I will say, and Joe, you can get in on this, but I will say, in Peterson's defense, Carson Wentz was really off in that first half. He missed some wide open throws. I'm talking the one where he missed with Aguilar. I mean, Nelson Aguilar is running wide open. The play design is genius. Like, Nelson Aguilar comes from the backside of the play, and he runs free to the play side, and everyone else takes all the defenders to the backside, and he's wide open. And Carson Wentz, it went over his head by 10 yards, you know. So I could understand why he wanted to, you know, test out the secondary, and he had some opportunities. Carson Wentz wasn't there. But I agree with you. He definitely could have banged it in there more to set up the pass better with the weakened secondary. But, Joe, what are you thinking?
I think the biggest thing right now, and I get it, you know, I'm a macro guy. That's how I always approach stuff. It seems very, very, very weird to me that we're looking at an NFC playoff picture where the four top teams are the Vikings, Eagles, Rams, and Saints. And I get it. That's just you flip the switch and say, oh, I guess we got to talk about Carson Wentz this way now. That the NFL has flipped a generation really, 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 really quickly. And I get it. Manning retiring helped accelerate that. Tom Brady's still playing phenomenal, but as soon as he goes, he's done. Phillip Rivers and Drew Brees are having some swan song moments, but it's just one of these things where when you see Jacksonville and you see the Rams and you see the Vikings with everybody around Case Keenum playing the way they are, and obviously Carson Wentz and the game that we're going to get next Sunday, it just feels like one of these next NFL era kind of games. And the way that we talk about, you know, Carson Wentz and Nelson Aguilar and Doug Peterson, like these were guys that just weren't on the map until however long ago. It's just so new that I think that's the biggest thing to me, is that it just seems so strange that we're not talking about up and coming teams the way that we used to 3, 4, 5 years ago. Now these teams are just here, and we accept the idea that Adam Thielen is a great wide receiver in the NFL. Like, how is it? What the hell? I know. Like, how is that even a thing that we're talking about? But it's true. It's just true.
Yeah, that's your guy.
It's
right
one
there.
Of those things where I know we crossed a bridge, and I don't know when we crossed it. But there's a new NFL that we're in now, and it's just still kind of weird. And maybe next Sunday is the first part that I have to get comfortable with it, and maybe it's going to be the playoffs. But it's one of those things where when we talk about the NFL now, it's a completely different landscape, and that's maybe the biggest takeaway from last night when you talk about the Eagles or when you talk about the Rams and what we've done the last 3 weeks. I think that's maybe more than anything. And obviously when you lock up your first winning season since 2003, it's going to be hard not to take stock of the bigger picture. But I think that's the one thing that I'm still struggling to catch up with, is that this isn't week one or week two. This isn't a one-game thing. The Rams are here. The Eagles are here. This is a real thing that's going to happen in the postseason, and that's where the NFL's headed.
You know, it's
interesting. For all the complaining about the NFL this season, and I think obviously there's a lot more – a lot of issues around that, but like, this is sort of everything you've ever wanted. I mean, it's like, you look at, like, the Jaguars are in the playoffs and they're a good team. You know, the Chargers are making a run, the Steelers, I mean, the Titans have a playoff spot, the Rams, the Eagles, the Saints. I mean, you know, this is, the Vikings are the top seed in the NFC. The Eagles are the second seed in the NFC. I mean, this isn't the same old, same old. I mean, this is a new, you're like you say, 3K, this is the start of a new era. I mean, and I think there's probably
the Broncos,
I mean, you have a lot of fans.
The Broncos
are, like,
are 3-9. They look horrible.
That's the craziest thing about it, though, because I don't know when the last time this has happened, but when you look at the landscape, like, the parity this year is unbelievable, because you have four division leaders that none of them made the playoffs last year. And all of the division leaders from the previous year are, like, in a rut, which I don't think that – in my 30 years, I've never seen the NFL have such a flip like that where it's literally the complete opposite. Not one division leader is the same, and it's literally a complete flip from what it was. Those division leaders are struggling on losing streaks and so on and so forth, or a bunch of injuries. It's like everything just collapsed for everyone that won last year, and then everyone that was at the bottom of the barrel the previous year is now at the top. So that's different. that's not something that you see
yep.
every day, but it creates that excitement, you know, because now you have those other fan bases with the bragging rights, which creates more trash talk. It's like, oh, you know, you have the Saints who haven't been at the top for a long time. They've been trying to get back there, but meanwhile, the Panthers and the Falcons have just been running that division, and now that's not the case. You know, the Saints are like kicking ass and taking names. You know, so I think it makes for an interesting dynamic to see that shift in powers.
You know what that means, though. You know what that means.
What?
2018. Cleveland Browns. I don't know how. I don't know who. I don't know what.
Oh, come on
but,
now. Something's never changed.
Listen now.
Something's never changed.
Don't you speak that evil, Ricky Bobby. don't you do it. because we all know when the Browns whoop everyone's ass and they're dominating in the playoffs that the world is going to end. We all know this.
Yeah.
So don't speak that evil.
Football apocalypse.
There you go. We know that we're going to have five moons just appear in the sky that day. So
five moons.
Let's avoid that. But so real quick with this Eagles Rams game, you know, this is one of those games where I don't think it's necessarily going to be a shootout. You know, if one team really gets hot, I think the other team will not. I personally think the Rams are more likely to. And this isn't homerism at all. This is just from tape study. I think the Rams are more likely to put up 35 than the Eagles, and that's because I think the Rams have better balance. I think they're more consistent in the pass game than what the Eagles are. Carson Wentz, he's getting a lot, and everyone knows I love Wentz. Let me make that clear. Everyone knows that from when he was coming out. Like, I'm a huge Wentz fan, but I'm also a realist, and the simple fact of the matter is over the last 6-7 weeks, he hasn't played anywhere close to as good as Jared Goff has played. In all aspects of quarterbacking, other than his mobility, you know, his ability to make nothing out of something is special. You know, it's second to Russell Wilson, and that's it. Maybe Case Keenum is in there with him, but that's it. But looking at the overall dynamic of each offense, I think the Rams are more likely to put up more points, but I'm not sure that they will because I think the teams really match up kind of well. I don't think it'll be a shootout. I think we're probably looking at something closer to what we saw with the Saints and the Rams last week, where it's kind of that average score for the NFL. But I wouldn't be shocked to see a low-scoring game either. So my question to you all is, what player do you think can really tilt this game in favor of their team? Like, if you could just take a player from either team, it doesn't really matter who, but what player do you think can really change things to really get that team over the hump if it's a close game?
I got a good one, but it's a very 3K one, so I definitely wanted to let Van be the smart guy, and then I'll be the jackass at the tail end.
Well, you know, the Eagles brought in J&J because he can break off those big plays. I mean, that's his whole – that's his MO. I mean, that's what the guy does. And, I wonder with this Rams, with the defense a little bit, with the run, if they can keep any of those kind of plays from really snapping off and going to the house or picking up 40 or 50 yards to make a difference like that, I think that's probably a good sign for the Rams. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But, you know, that's a guy I have my eye on for this game. I mean, I think that's a big tell for me, you know, where, you know, how squared away the Rams defense is going to be.
I'm torn between
all
two
right,
guys,
Joe.
And they're the same
jackass,
two guys that it's jackass. Well, it's anytime I'm talking to jackass, it's the same two guys that maybe had the major impact this last weekend that have that overwhelming impact on games that guys at their positions don't have from other teams, and it's Greg Zuerlein and Johnny Hecker. As much as special teams can depend on a splash play like Michael Brockers blocking a kick or what's his name? Tariq Cohen, right? Had that punt return. And even for Farrell Cooper, we've seen some great returns this year. The play out of our punter and kicker is just so damn good and so much better than any punter-kicker combo. I mean, you got Greg Zuerlein on possibly going to break LaDainian Tomlinson's scoring record. Johnny Hecker is putting in just a phenomenal career for a punter through 5 years. It's one of those things where those guys win games not because they go out and do it in the way that a running back takes over a game, a quarterback, but because the subtlety of what they do prevents the other team from taking advantage of certain situations. You saw this last weekend. The Rams were backed up on their own goal line. Johnny Hecker booms the kick and flips the field. Then when we get the ball back with a good return, we're able to change the game. And Hecker doesn't get that kind of credit, but what he does is set other people up to get that credit. So I'll take Greg Zuerlein for the guy that maybe is the X factor, a guy that takes over a game, but maybe doesn't do it with the headlines, but we'll do it because he gets set up by other people and sets the Rams up for better situations down the road.
Yeah, that punt you're talking about, he boomed it 70 yards. What made that punt hilarious to me, like I literally laughed watching it. And then when I reviewed the tape last night, I laughed again because maybe 5 minutes before that punt, you know, we're in the chat and Bate goes, man, what's up with Hecker? he hasn't been kicking himself. Literally, like 5 minutes. It's almost like he sensed it. Was like, Brendan Bate is speaking of me. And he just went out there and rocked it. He just absolutely rocked it. I was just like, well, there's the punch you've been waiting for. Completely changed the field position. And then the Rams get a 3-and-out. And then when they get the ball back, they're at half field.
Yep.
Just like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking that in the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, we should just take a break from the show because I'm starting to feel like I talk to you too much or something, Joe, because we're starting to have the same type of answers because without even knowing that Hecker and Zuerlein was my picks that could really switch this game because I'll use fantasy for an example, okay, fantasy football. If you have Greg Zuerlein, you know, most years in fantasy, the best kickers in fantasy – from a year-to-year base, is going to get you 9 to 10 points a game, you know, that you can count on. Greg Zuerlein is getting people like 16, 17. he's kicking so well, and he's averaging like 4 kicks a game or something, 4 field goals a game that he's hitting. And he's on the record, the NFL record for most field goals in a season is 44, and I think right now he's at 37. So he's going to break that record. You know, he's going to break that record, and you already mentioned that he's on pace of breaking LaDainian Tomlinson's record. What Greg Zuerlein is doing is really unbelievable, but more so the reason that I said Hecker and Zuerlein is because I can't think of a time in NFL history where you had the unquestioned unanimous best punter in the league and has been the best punter for years. And then you have the best kicker where they have such an impact on the game.
Together.
You know, one thing that I don't think people have given Greg Zuerlein enough credit for is that, yeah, the Rams are averaging, you know, over 30 points a game, but they also have a kicker who's been getting of those, you know, if the Rams are averaging 30 points a game, Greg Zuerlein has been getting 15 of those points a game, you know, about 12 to 15 by himself. You know, it hasn't been the offense has just been tearing it up, you know, because the offense has had struggles of punching it in from the red zone. Greg Zuerlein has just been money. And without his consistency, the Rams, they're probably averaging 25, 26 points a game, which is a huge difference. You know, so I definitely think that when you're talking about two players or any player that can really tilt it, you have to look at Hecker, you have to look at Zuerlein. Those two guys have been phenomenal. Like if you could give special teams players MVP, one of them would probably get it. But we know that'll never happen.
No doubt. Hey, I do want to let Ryan go. We've taken up enough of his time. One thing I did want to mention, and this is kind of a segue back to the larger scales. When we talk about Johnny Hecker and Greg Zuerlein, to borrow a favorite phrase from an era, a bygone era of Tricia Times and a bygone era of America, it's kind of the opposite of what you used to talk about all the time, Van, was the bigotry of low expectations, right? And that now it's the opposite, right? When you talk about Hecker and Greg Zuerlein, the most disappointing play of the year for me for the Rams was when they rolled Zuerlein out to try that, 64-yard field goal 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Right
yeah.
at the end of half.
And he
didn't make it. Because I was like, this is it. This is Greg Zuerlein just putting his foot in the ass of the NFL and saying, look at us. Look at kickers and punters. And he missed it. And it was one of those things where I really felt he was going to do it. The Rams kind of now are suffering from the bigotry of high expectations. And that may be the weirdest thing of all. And that's why we wanted to have you on, man. It was a perfect time to have you back. I appreciate it. Hey, I can't thank you enough.
It's
and
great
this is
to
on
be
behalf
back.
Of everybody for years and years of Tersho Times mired in what's the right word? The paper mache of football that we had to go through.
It was complete purgatory. That's what it was.
It's purgatory. It was, there's a lot of analogies we could use.
You remember, like, switching? It was November 1st that we started talking about the draft.
Yep.
I can't get it out of my system. I posted about it today because it's December 4th. You're supposed to update the draft order. That's what you do.
Yeah. No,
it's just
draft
a different
yet.
World, man. A different world.
It is. And we'll adjust. Thanks for coming on, Van.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. It's good to be back.
Absolutely. Definitely appreciated this one. This is going to be a good one to talk about tomorrow.
You bet.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for coming on, man. Take care.
Ryan Van Bibber, former managing editor of Tersho Times, current NFL editor for SB Nation. Follow him at JustRVB, the original. What did you call the prodigal son?
The prodigal son. That's right. He rose from the ashes like the phoenix. He came back to holler at his TST folk.
I just love the idea of, like, you know, Ryan creating Tersho Times, moving on to managing editor. Tersho Times is like this growing, you know, what's the right? I don't want to say the wrong thing because we're not like Stranger Things. We're not that evil monster spreading its arms throughout the internet. But we're a growing behemoth, and I'm glad to be a part of it, man. And we got
absolutely
nobody more to thank for that than RBB.
This is true, and I agree with that. I'm very glad to be part of it. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about it the other day when, you know, it was confirmed that Ryan was coming on. I was just like, man, I started having like a flashback to how, like, when it all, like, how I got onto the staff and everything and how it all started.
When did you start? When did you come on staff?
I came on staff in 2013. And I know, right? Well, no. I take that back. I didn't come on staff in 2013. I started writing in the fan section in 2000. Mm-hmm. I was writing shit like every day.
Yeah.
And I think the thing where the first time I ever really just kind of talked with Ryan was I wrote a piece on Sam Bradford. You know, the complaint was about him checking down, and I was talking about the issues of protection, you know, and the smart move to make with that time was the check down. And that was the first thing that was the first time I had wrote something that was taken from the fan section and put onto the front page. And that was when I first started talking to Ryan. And from there, right, talking with Doug, and that's kind of, you know, probably like 2 months later, was when I joined the staff. But I was thinking about that. I was just like, geez, has he really been gone that long? And then I started thinking, I was like, wait a second. Have I really been writing on the staff that long?
Yeah.
It was like that flashback. So, but like you said, it all starts like right there when you have guys like Ryan and Doug, and, you know, we do this because what they did, you know, they got the ball rolling. So definitely appreciate him. Shout out to those guys.
RVB in the day.
So you mentioned something real quick before we get to listener questions. You mentioned something about
I don't want to talk about Rippets anymore, man. Move
we're
on.
We're not talking about Rippets. We're not talking about liquid meth, okay? But you mentioned something. You said that the expectations are for are now just good. You know, there's no more.
Yeah.
You've been so bad. You'll take anything pretty much. Now it's like, no, this isn't good enough. And real quick, before we get to these questions, we have to discuss Andrew Whitworth. We cannot let this show close without discussing it. Andrew Whitworth has been good. There's no denying that.
Very good.
There's no way around it.
Very good.
He's been very, very good, you know.
Yeah.
And my thing is, and, you know, people say it's father time, but I don't think it is because it's not like he's gone, you know, the past 3 years where he's gotten all his Pro Bowl recognition and all pro and things like that. It's not like he's gone without giving up a single sack or anything like that. But it is something that I'm noticing is that when he plays those above average pass rushers with long arms and decent speed, that's where he seems to struggle with. And he has not been the Rams' best offensive lineman. I think if anything, you should, if you're going to give him credit,
not
for anything,
the last couple
not
weeks.
His play. is not his play, but his leadership. If you're going to give him credit for anything, I think his leadership has helped. But the best offensive lineman, hands down, has been Roger Saffold week in and week out. It's not even remotely close. Like, he's
on the field,
he's kicking ass out there, you know, so it's not even close. And then after that, I would say that it's been John Sullivan, followed by Whitworth, and then you get to the two young guys. But Whitworth, he struggled, and I think that it's something that we need to talk about because we have to think about the future. I honestly think after next year, Whitworth is done, and that's if he's not done after this. And when I say done, I don't mean he's going to retire. I mean he's not going to be what you're paying for. So I think he might have one more year in him where he could play to a good enough level where you're comfortable having him protecting his blind side. But speaking of the draft there, you know, towards the end with Ryan, how high do you think we have to look at possibly getting a tackle in this upcoming draft or free agency? Maybe?
I mean, it's got to be in the mix. It's got to be in the mix. And, you know, I said that before the season started. Now, what I wasn't necessarily anticipating was that first, eight games that Andrew Whitworth put in where he was spectacular. And here's the thing. It's really only the last three games where Whitworth has had some stretches of play that didn't match up to what he was putting in for the first stretch of the season. If it had been the opposite, if he had played the first three games where he had had some difficulties with some of those guys, and then for the last eight games or nine games had been spectacular, it wouldn't invite these kind of questions. It's just the way that time works. Because he put in, you know, eight or nine really good games, and the last 3 weeks has had some plays where he hasn't been great. He's been good, but he hasn't been great. It's one of those things where you start to ask, okay, if he's gone from eight or nine great games to a couple good games, does he go from good back to great, or does he stick at good, or does he go from good to whatever's next? And if he gets to whatever's next, especially when we start getting into these important games, there's no avoiding that, right? And I get it. People can say, you know, well, Chandler Jones is a great pass rusher. He is. That's absolutely true. And you can look at the Saints and the Vikings and say they've got some really, really good talent. That's absolutely true. But if you're trying to be one of the best left tackles in the NFL and you're protecting your quarterback from that position, you got to be able to handle those guys. That's the job. And nobody says about, like, Tyron Smith or – I don't know, whoever else you want to throw in that position as being at the top around the league, well, they're going up against good talent. That's what you do. When you get to the playoffs, guess what you got to do? You got to go up against really talented guys. And that's not an excuse that you can use. So it's just one of those things where, because it's happened the last couple of weeks where we've had a couple moments to look at Andrew Whitworth and isolate him, where it's nobody else, where it's just Andrew Whitworth on a play and say, yeah, he just didn't get it done. It's one of those things that starts cropping up the question. As to how you approach it in the draft, I mean, the one thing that I mentioned in the draft order today that I mainly wanted to update just because we're at the three-quarter poll. We're at 75% of the regular season's done, so we know where most of the NFL is looking at for the draft order. The big issue is similar to what we had 2 years ago when we traded up for Jared Goff. Because of the trade with Sammy Watkins, we don't have a second-round pick. So we've got this big gap. Right. Where we're only going to have one pick in the first, you know, what do you want to say, 80 picks of the draft. And so there's just not a lot of opportunity to upgrade many positions. And because, and we've mentioned this, I know, a couple times, so longtime listeners will want to fast forward through this part, is the idea that the Rams have to get to March because we got so many expiring contracts. LaMarcus Joyner, Connor Barwin, Nickell Robey-Coleman, Trumaine Johnson. There's a ton of Sammy Watkins. There's a ton of guys where those decisions on their contracts are just as important as the talent level that we're at right now. And so should offensive line and specifically left tackle be in the mix? It has to be. The problem is the Rams have some immediate needs that they're going to hit in March that maybe don't seem like it right now. And so it's a little preemptive to try to lay out roster needs, you know, week 13 compared to when we get to, what is it, March 14th, I think, is the beginning of the next league year. That's going to be the chance where we really get to see, okay, if we lose Trumaine Johnson and Nickell Robey-Coleman and Kayvon Webster maybe is coming out of injury or, you know, the way he's played, I don't know. It's one of those things where you look at and say, okay, unquestionably cornerback's the top need. I don't know. It's one of those things where we just got to get there before we really know. But in terms of just the natural talent level, the value of the position, and where you need to be for this team moving forward, I'd have no problem starting to think about drafting a tackle of the future, no doubt.
So real quick, let's get to these listener questions. And we have one from, and I had to make sure we got this on here, because he's a Rams fan from Stockholm, Sweden. Okay.
Stockholm. Love it.
Yeah, so when we have listeners calling in, and it's like, man, how are you guys coming from all over the place? Let's beat this one. Stockholm, Sweden. Take that. So Dennis Dooley, he had a question broken up into three parts. And it's the first one is, Samson Ebukam keep his job when Barwin comes back? And he's like, he sure thinks so. I wouldn't be completely surprised if he did, but I don't – he will, just because of, you know, the leadership that Barwin brings, and plus he has that connection with Wade Phillips from their history. But I wouldn't be completely surprised. I wouldn't be completely surprised if he did keep it. What I am surprised with is the fact that we're even having the conversation of him keeping it. Because when he was drafted, myself for sure, but a lot of people were just like, who the hell did they just pick? You know, and sure, he's actually played pretty well. You know, he's played pretty well. So the fact that we're having this conversation is probably what's really the most surprising there. His next part of his question, Joe, did you have anything on that one?
No, it's just one of those things. When you come out of Eastern Washington, you know, you're never going to have great name recognition. Although, I guess Cooper Kupp has had as much name recognition as you could possibly get out of EWU.
Yeah.
The thing that I think is interesting is, and to put it in perspective of what you said, this isn't a John Johnson, Maurice Alexander issue where Connor Barwin is being shed and they're just moving on. Connor Barwin's going to come back. What's different is that Samson Ebukam is going to have a chance to maybe push Connor Barwin out of the way. That's what you get with injuries. You get a chance to step up and play your way into the lineup. And if he does that, so be it. But if not, that's the reason they brought Connor Barwin over on a one-year deal, is to be a plug-and-play guy. And if Samson Ebukam isn't, you know, necessarily playing up to the level that the coaching staff wants, then you go back to Barwin. And it doesn't have to be, you know, career poison for Ebukam. He's a rookie, right?
Yeah.
A day three rookie out of a non-FBS team. That's okay. It's just one of those things where, you know, it is what it is. He's getting a chance, and we'll see what he does.
Quarterback. He's not the franchise quarterback.
I mean, he wasn't a first-round draft pick.
It doesn't do as much damage as it would for that guy. His second question here is, what are your thoughts on the Rams rookie class? I mean, all of them but Price and Rodgers played almost rookie mistake-free football. No flags, no bullshit. They all look like good football players. What do you think, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get away. The thing that, and maybe this is just a credit to this coaching staff, is they're isolating these guys with what they can do, whether it's Cooper Kupp, Josh Reynolds, Gerald Everett, Samson Ebukam, Juan Price, you know, and obviously he's having to take a step back. They moved on from him this week, where they're not forcing guys into certain situations. And we've seen that with rookies in the past. And again, I don't want to relitigate this whole idea of Jeff Fisher being the worst coach ever. But when you look at some of the rookies and guys that the Rams really needed to depend on, whether it was second round rookies like Brian Quick and Isaiah Pea, or you know, other guys that were brought, Greg Robinson, brought in to be the next kind of guy that didn't necessarily prepare for the position the way that they needed to, and then got handled the same way they did with Jared Goff or, Trey Mason, other rookies that had the competence. It's one of those things where it seemed like it was a blanket preparation of just whatever. This is how we deal with rookies, regardless of who they are, regardless of the situation. The Rams this year didn't necessarily do that. Cooper Kupp was ready to go from week one. Gerald Everett was ready to go from week one. Other guys weren't. And it seems hard to criticize. The only thing you can criticize them is maybe limited production, but without a first-round pick, and given that the Rams are 9-3, that seems like a pretty unnecessary criticism, especially because if we get to next year and some of these guys are balling out, that's going to fall on deaf ears. So, yeah, I totally think it's a good football players, a great class, and it's one of those things where the Rams have turned things around. And when you do that, it's not necessarily about looking at where we are in week 12. It's where we are, you know, into the postseason and into year 2 and year 3 for these guys.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's different. You know, you have guys that came in ready, and then even for the guys that wasn't getting clock early on and doing much, getting much more as time went on, like John Johnson and like Samson Ebukam, like those guys came in and they really made a difference. And Tenzel Smart, I've said it before, when he was put inserted in and Brockers was moved to the side, it completely changed the defense. You know, so I think the Rams really did a really good job with their rookie class. They really kind of knocked it out of the park with a lot of under the radar picks, if that's fair to say, because that while they did get some big names in those picks, Gerald Everett was talked about a lot pre-draft, and Cooper Kupp was like Jesus. And then you have Tenzel Smart. He was a 6th round pick, but he was a guy that everyone knew and everyone talked about, and he even had some Aaron Donald comparisons. You know, so it wasn't like these guys were unknown, but they were under the radar because of probably draft position when they were able to get some of these guys. So overall, I do think that it's thus far through 12 games, it has been a successful draft. I'm really disappointed that Price was waived, though. For I understand that they had to move some pieces around, and you know it's the expendable piece because of he's buried on the depth chart. But whatever, we'll see. But nevertheless, I'm still looking forward to Price getting on the field.
He can always come back. The one angle that I throw in there is that the level of difficulty for this draft wasn't that high. This wasn't a draft that the Rams had to nail. They could just sit back, let the draft come, and they did. Let the draft come to you, trade down, add a bunch of guys that fit the, you know, roles of what you're trying to fill, because this wasn't a year where you really had to staff up. They did that in free agency. What might be different is this year, whether we lose Trumaine Johnson or Sammy Watkins or some of these other really, really core, LaMarcus Joyner, any of these core components, when you got a first-round pick, that's when the degree of difficulty ramps up to a severe degree, and the Rams are going to need to nail next year's draft much more than this one. Because what you know what's going to happen, Mason, is whether it's 2018 or 2019, those are the drafts where you're going to need to get stars, and Gerald Everett and Cooper Kupp and some of these guys will just be producing in the background, but you're going to need to get a Sammy Watkins or Trumaine Johnson, somebody on that level to really star for this team moving forward because of who they're going to have to replace.
Absolutely. So real quick, before we get to college football and get out of here, one thing, it's not a question, but Luke Cromery says, can we all just appreciate how excited Ted Raff, the strength and conditioning coach, gets after every Rams first
he
down?
He gets hyped.
Yes, we can. He's like the Flavor Flav for the Rams. He's the hype man. So, absolutely, we can appreciate that. Thank you, Ted Raff, for bringing such energy to the Rams. College football, Joe, what do you have?
Well, what's great about Ted Raff is it's his first year, and so I think he's having his rookie moment where he's having his virgin success on the sideline. I'm glad to see it, man. So good for him, good for the coach staff. College football, good Lord, man. I mean, it was championship week. You know, the one thing we said, and look, this is one that we're on the very, very, very far periphery of college football media, was that there was going to be no way to get this college football playoff right, and they proved that. And I told you a couple weeks ago Alabama was going to be in this playoff, and they found a way to make that happen. And it just is what it is, man. I mean, it's going to be a good showcase. I love some of the bowl games that we got moving forward. We did not get the Tertia Radio Bowl, sadly. North Texas did not get Missouri.
They were scared.
North Texas is headed. I was so ready for it. I think we might have had to win. We obviously lost to Florida Atlantic and Lane Kiffin, which, by the way, get him the hell out of Conference USA. Get out of Conference USA, Lane Kiffin. I get it. You've got talent. Get the fuck out of here. We don't want you in here anymore. This is not a place for you. But North Texas going back to the New Orleans Bowl. I like what we got at the top, man. It's going to be a great season. I was looking at some of the draft stuff today after I posted the draft order, and we had some updated rankings. I think it was last week from Mel Kiper just going through his top 10 at the position. Some of these classes, especially wide receiver, I'm not really big on that class. So as much as we get to go through bowl games and scout and all these things, what it starts to do is shape the matching of the classes to value, where if you're a team that needs a number one overall wide receiver, this is a bad year to need that.
I would say that with this year, the interesting thing about it,
Not, and now, don't get me wrong. It's not that I think that they should have got in. I would say that it's just that it hasn't happened in the 3 years that the playoff system has been real. Alabama has no significant impactful win on their schedule. None. You know, they are in strictly off name. And you knew they were going to get in when they only dropped to 5 because that's
right.
how they do it.
And the quality,
it
was, I, and the quality
you knew
of the play. I mean, you get, yeah.
You, they sure. were setting it up so that they could guarantee that they get in because someone in the top four had to lose, you know. So
right.
when you kind of look at the, when you kind of look at just how it all shook out, they it was set up for Alabama to get in, but they didn't really have that significant win. Now, when I say it's not because I wanted them to get in or anything like that, I'm talking about Ohio State. But Ohio State, you know, I understand the anger from the Ohio State fans because you look at they beat 2 top 10 ranked teams, you know, and they beat three teams in total that was ranked in the top 15. Alabama did not. They beat no one ranked in the top 10. They, you know, the Ohio State, they were top, I think, 10 in offense and defense. You know, so when you just kind of look at the grand scheme of things, I understand why the fans were upset. But at the end of the day, I do not think Ohio State beats Alabama. If you put those two hands up, I don't think they beat Alabama. Alabama, they haven't had any significant wins. Alabama has not looked like the dominant Alabama that got them the name recognition to just put them in the playoffs like they did. They don't look like that Alabama. And personally, I don't think Alabama can beat Clemson or forget that. I think Clemson might be the best team in the country. I don't think Alabama can beat Oklahoma.
Sure.
You know, I don't think they. I don't think there's a chance in hell Alabama could stop Baker Mayfield. That's just the simple truth of the matter. Alabama is basically riding the coattails of Alabama of the past. And so I think this playoff is really kind of going to take the college football into the off season and have them really considering changing the amount of teams that get in. I personally don't think they should, because the reason that this past weekend was so exciting is because there's only 4 teams. And I like that. Personally, I like the 4 teams because it creates such excitement. Every game counts. But I do think that the backlash that they're receiving right now, I think is ultimately going to cause them to reconsider some things. And we could possibly see a suspension on the playoff teams.
I think that the biggest thing that they got out of 2016 was that the championship whitewashed how badly the 2 other teams that made the 3rd and 4th seed last year play, right? So we had a phenomenal championship, and so the cap that you get on the season, and especially because we had that Rose Bowl from USC Penn State where, you had 2 quarterbacks, Trace McSorley and Sam Darnold, just playing balls out, great game. Then you cap it off with a national championship between Clemson and Alabama, and everybody feels kind of good about going into 2017. But what it wiped away was the fact that Oklahoma and Michigan State got washed. They got washed. And it made it question at the time, why did we put these teams in there? We were already questioning the selection at the time, but we could lean on, oh, these factors and this over here, blah, 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 blah. But when you get those results, it makes you question it even worse, because this year the selection questioning is so much more vociferous. If Alabama doesn't play well, if they get wiped by Clemson, everybody's coming at that the whole process. Everybody's going to come to it and say, look, there's no – we get it that Alabama was beating the teams that they were dealing with pretty significantly early on, and they dealt with injuries, and that people were going off of, like you said, name recognition, program strength, and just their reputation more so than anything to get them in the playoffs. But if we get a bad game from them against Clemson, everybody's coming. They're going to say, no, this didn't make any damn sense. Look at the game. Look at what happened. You got Auburn playing UCF, right? In which bowl is that? I had it up earlier. In the Peach Bowl. You had Auburn playing UCF in the Peach Bowl. Auburn was in the SEC championship. Alabama wasn't. Georgia wins the SEC championship. If they get washed out by Oklahoma, it's going to be one of those things where people look at this and say, okay, we got to go back to the drawing board because it's just not making any difference.
Absolutely.
So put the opposite up there, though. If Alabama wipes Clemson, or even if they just win, then it's going to silence a lot of those doubters. So, I mean, that's the good thing about it is you get to play for it. This isn't the BCS. You get these games. It's just one of those things where I worry that because everybody's sniping at Alabama in place of Ohio State and maybe even in place of a couple other teams, look at USC, you know, the game's going to decide that, and that's what we got to get to. So that's the interesting thing. The good thing is there's so many damn bowl games, man, and there's so much talent to get to look at. You got Penn State, Washington, the Fiesta Bowl, Miami, Wisconsin, and the Orange. Auburn, I mentioned, against UCF. UCF doesn't have a ton of NFL talent, but Auburn's stacked in the Peach Bowl. Notre Dame, LSU, and the Citrus Bowl. There's so much NFL talent in that one. And then, obviously, you get to the playoffs. It's stacked, man. There's going to be a ton of talent for Brand fans to be able to look at and think about when we get into that part of December where we know where we're headed in the playoffs, but maybe not where we're heading contractually for next month.
Which the next month is going to be very good.
Oh, what did I say? I mentioned something to Professor, and I said something like, the next 2 weeks, my body's not ready. I'm not ready. I don't know that I'm ready for this, man.
Better get ready. Better get you a Rivet. Get you some extra.
I guess. Better pound that Rivet. Pound that Rivet and get ready. That's right.
Better get you an extra boost and get ready because it's coming.
Rivet won't get me ready to watch the game. Rivet will make me think, hey, you know what? I could probably play left guard. You know what? Fuck it. Put me in, coach. I can play guard. 6'1", 200 pounds.
Worst spot and block Chandler Jones.
That's right. I can handle Chandler Jones. Give me another one of those raspberry rippets. Give me one of those blue raspberries. I can get in there.
This reminds me of Family Guy when Peter first tried Red Bull.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
That's going to be you.
Multiply that times three, and there you go. The good thing is that going into this week, man, we got some games, bro. If everybody's talking about the NFC South, that's kind of the portal to the side, the playoff selection, you start with New Orleans at Atlanta on Thursday, right? That's already on the docket. Then by the time you get to Sunday, you got Minnesota at Carolina in the early games. Late games, you got Philadelphia at us, Washington at the Chargers, and Seattle at Jacksonville. Sunday's going to be crazy.
Yes. That's why I'm so looking forward to this weekend. This has been a good weekend on the schedule for a lot of teams. So I think that ultimately we're going to get some good football this weekend. It's going to lead us into the following weekend with even better football with some of these college games and bowl games getting going. And it's that time of year, Joe. The sad part is that, you know, for all the positives, there's a negative, which is means football season is coming to an end quickly. So we have to soak it up, enjoy it as much as we possibly can. We only have a few more regular season shows before we get into the off season, talking about free agency and stuff. So let's soak it up. Let's enjoy it. Get some ripping in our system. Hit us some golden yak, gold yaks and mouth and everything.
Golden
mouth and everything else. And everything else. But for, real quick, got definitely again, give one more shout out to Ryan RBB coming on the show. Definitely appreciate it. Make sure we're tuning into the game this week. Let's see. Where are we at? We're in L.A. So drew a blank there. We're in L.A. So 3:15 L.A. Pacific time. What is that on the East Coast, Joe?
I was coming in at 4. It's going to be at 1 o'clock. Yeah, 1 o'clock on their time, 4 o'clock our time.
Yeah,
it's going to be dope, man.
My times are all out of whack. Long work days.
It's all good.
But y'all
middle of the country people and y'all time zones.
I know. We're torn. You know, we're like the middle child. But make sure you guys are tuning in. Follow the show at Turf Show Times. Make sure you follow myself at Mighty or Myson. And then, of course, follow Joe at 3K with the random underscore, 3K underscore. Or follow all of us on Twitter. That's all we got for this week, and we out.
Big bad Jackie and I'm starting us off. The Rams get down so nobody scoffs. And don't you worry, cause the Rams are rapping. When game time comes, we'll be back to zapping. We can't sing and our dance is not pretty, but we'll do our best for the team and the city. So get on your feet and clap your hands. Let's ram it right now with the L.A. Rams.
Hollywood handsome, Dodge City tough. If you throw it my way, it's gonna get rough. I like to ram it, as you can see. Nobody likes ramming any more than me.
They call me Zeta, nobody dresses sweeter. But under this cool is a quarterback mistreater. I come from the end, looking for the sacks. I don't stop coming till I put them on the back.
This limousine with it, my moves are like dreams. They call me the demon on special team. I know how to rock from the toes to the head. When I pull the trigger, I'll knock you dead.
I'm a mountain man from West VA. They call me Herc, and I came to play. I learned long ago to ram it just right. You can ram it all day and ram it all night.
Ram it.
I catch what they throw me and I like to block. I'm quick off the line as I can be, cause I don't want dick running over me.
This is baby face and I don't yield. I'm a Texan fool on the football field. From the Jersey Shore to Baboa Bay, if you run at me, you'll have a bad day.
This is RB, no Speedball Brown. Fastest man in the whole damn town. Cars and ladies are a part of my creed, but more than that, I feel the need for speed.
This is catcher, out to make a run. With shade on, I can catch a BB in the dark. So now you're ready and I'm sure you'll agree, the ramming is fun when you're ramming with me.
Style and class, if you come my way, I'll knock you on your ass. Okay, your name's intimidated. I pass it my way, I'll see you later. Quick on my feet, the ladies agree. Before they know it, they'll ram it with me. The Iceman coming, Leroy is the name. I cover the corner, interception's my game. Score more than anybody else on the D, cause I move like a cat, as you will see.
The guys call me Dick instead of Dick the Son. I lead the Rangers, I'm the Rams top gun. They say I'm as smooth as a runner can be. Even sweetness and the others are talking about me. I like to dance and have a lot of fun. When it comes to ladies, want a brainy one. But enough about me, we hit a ram it, you see. If you ram it just right, you can ram it all night.
Ram it.
All right, so look, here's the deal. If you're trying to run, clothes just slow you down. And I'm not saying it was the rip it. I'm not saying it was me at the time. I was a young man. I wanted to break free. But clothes slow you down. And that's just the truth. So damn it, don't blame rip it and don't blame me.